Hello, Food Chain. This is Sharon Chitona, and I'm a food tech junkie and innovation nerd who loves a good story. This podcast combines all of my favorite vices into a deep dive about the problems our food system faces and the visionary people working on solutions. In this episode, we meet Sonali Figueras, founder of Green Queen, an impact media platform, and CEO of Source Green, an online marketplace that connects brands with eco-friendly packaging solutions. The serial social entrepreneur and eco-activist is on a mission to shift consumer behavior by inspiring and empowering audiences through original content. Her passion for sustainability stretches beyond her business ventures, as she is also a venture partner at Better Bite Ventures and an advisor to Climate League. As a food tech junkie, Sonali's innovative mindset has paved the way for impactful change in Asia's food and beverage industry and across the globe. She's an inspiration to many, and her dedication to making the world a greener, more sustainable place is truly remarkable. Are you ready? Here we go. Hi, Sonali. How are you?
Hi, Sharon. How are you? It's so great to be here.
It's great to have you. I mean, there's a lot to dive into. We are in very particular times, and to have someone like you makes it all the better. But before we dive into all of that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started?
Sure. It's a story that, you know, a lot of people maybe have heard me say, so I'll keep it a little bit brief, but essentially I got into this space because of my own personal health issues. So I, in my kind of late teens, early 20s, was very unwell with multiple things that were wrong with me. I would say nothing life-threatening, but very painful and very kind of life-disrupting. And nobody could really figure out what was wrong with me. I suffered from what I call medical misogyny, where, you know, I was mostly seeing older white male doctors that were just not paying attention to my symptoms. And so I ended up, as someone who is naturally extremely curious and a researcher at heart, absolutely, since I was a small kid, this was right around the time that Google, the search engine, came out. And I suddenly had this access where I was able to kind of deep dive into all these subjects. And so I sort of started using all these tools, you know, things like WebMD, but also just open-ended searches. And I ended up finding medical papers around some of my symptoms. And I started, you know, getting a little bit into this health and wellness world. And I realized that, you know, what I was eating was having an effect on my symptoms. Eventually, I did get some diagnoses for what I have. I have endometriosis. I have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is an autoimmune disorder. I have insulin resistance, which is likely due to my heritage. My grandfather actually died because his pancreas burst. So there's some kind of issue with pancreas-related stuff in my background. And so I essentially totally changed how I ate. And that made me then go into a deep dive on food and how it's grown. And once I started getting into agriculture, I started getting into kind of systems like pollution and water systems and air and soil. And then that where it all led to kind of climate stuff. And I think the biggest takeaway from that was, why had no one told me any of this? Why did my doctor not talk about food? Why did my parents not know anything about this? Why was everyone on the news not screaming about these problems? Because it became very obvious to me that our food system was, you know, severely challenged and broken and not set up for success, given, you know, where the climate was going. And you're talking about 15 years ago now, so it's a long time ago. I was very alone in my thoughts and very kind of, you know, didn't have anyone really to talk to, came from a financial and management consulting background. Nobody cared, you know, nobody had any interest or knowledge around these topics. So, you know, very much kind of just kept going and changed my whole life. The products I used, the way I ate, you know, what kind of motivated me, because then I started learning about the stories of people that were creating solutions for people like me and to solve some of these issues. And so that led me to create my first startup, Eco Warehouse, which is around organic trade and kind of connecting certified organic producers and farmers and suppliers with buyers in the B2B space. And that led me to getting my feet really wet with supply chain and the food system in that sense. And so I was attending all these shows, et cetera, every year, going to all the big food shows, especially the organic ones and the more progressive one. And then that's where I first came into contact with some of the earliest alternative protein companies.
Yeah.
And really, really started to understand that something was different about some of these companies.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I had started Greek Queen as a blog, which had quickly turned into a news site because I have not really got much interest in myself being the face of something. That's something that it's taken me a very long time to even come to terms with where we've landed now. But at heart, I'm actually someone who is much more interested in the issues than I am in talking about myself. And so Green Queen immediately found an audience and started growing. And so alongside the startup, I had Green Queen, and about 2015, we wrote the first article in Asia, I believe, and maybe outside of the US and the Netherlands. It was the first article about alternative protein companies in Asia around Beyond Meat, Impossible Food, Hampton Creek, which is now a new wave food, like all the early, that early batch. And I sort of said, these companies are different.
Yeah.
These are not your average vegan burger companies. These people are trying to do something else. These people have a different thesis. They have a different image. They have a different mission. And I felt that was very, very interesting and unique.
Yeah.
And I felt that that there was this famous UN report that came out in 2006. It was that seminal report that connected livestock agriculture emissions with climate. And that was really starting to make the rounds, and people were starting to make that connection. And I felt, okay, there's something here that's different, and we're going to start telling that story. And I felt very strongly that Asia needed to be part of that story early on, because the mainstream media still skews incredibly US and to some extent Europe, but very much the US. And so a lot of what we react to and we invest in and we live out are US cultural trends.
Yeah, and that happens with everything, like politics, first of all. It's like what happens there translates everywhere afterwards.
Exactly.
Very interesting. We actually have very similar stories about our health. And that's what sparked my interest in this field and food innovation, better health, better planet. But let's talk about you. You have a huge plate, obviously Green Queen, another company. You're an advisor. You're a venture partner. You do so many things, and you are a mom. So congratulations.
I am a very happy, proud mom. Motherhood is much more rewarding than I even thought it would be. But I will say, everyone told me that I would be less into my work, and that is not true.
For real? I don't know. For me, that doesn't change. At least if you're driven, why would it?
Yeah. A lot of people made me think it would, and it didn't change at all. So it just, my plate had to get bigger. It wasn't a question of reducing the stuff on the plate, as you said.
It just gets bigger. Actually, for me as a mom, the thing that my daughter, I think, is most proud of is the work I do, you know?
Exactly.
And I think that's cool. So in addition to alternative protein, which we'll dive into shortly, you also look at alternative packaging as a problem. What are some of the, I would say, the greatest challenges that you see in our food system?
I would have to say that the greatest challenge I see in our food system today, after having done this for so long, is that nobody seems to understand, or very, very, very few people seem to understand, that we do not solve the climate crisis without solving the food crisis. And that is my biggest pain point. That is what I talk about constantly when I go speak to the public, which I do a lot. I think I consider that a lot of my kind of free work. I speak to schools, universities, corporates, of course, as well, which is not free, but I spend a lot of time doing advocacy, and I give a lot of my time for panels. And I'm constantly amazed about this disconnect. And I think it says something about our industry that we have not done a very good job about making that connection.
Yes.
And that, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was saying exactly that. I mean, everybody thinks that, you know, climate is just fossil fuels, energy, and nobody thinks that food takes a huge role also because it has everything. It has packaging, it has energy, it has resources, water. Everything that pollutes is in food, basically.
Absolutely. But I mean, even more granularly than that, I mean, we're all data obsessed. I mean, 1/3 of greenhouse gas emissions come from our food system. And yet, as you very well pointed out, in climate reporting and climate talking, it's all energy and transportation and fossil fuels. And it is nobody. I was once in a conference with, multiple times actually, there was a conference of all these kind of chief sustainability officers or ESG folks, that type of thing. And not one person seemed to know anything about even the stat I just gave you, the connection between greenhouse gas emissions and the food system. So that tells you where that group of people is focused on, right? And then another one is I was at one of the largest, if not the largest, sustainability event in Hong Kong. And there were about 120 panels during the 3-day event, and only 2 were about food. And I was on both of them, and that was really sad.
Yeah.
And so that tells you where we are. I mean, really, it should be a percentage of emission in terms of the number of fat, right? So that's how we should be thinking about things. But that basic education is not there. And what I find is a huge problem is that reporters, journalists, editors are not at all schooled in the topic. And so you end up with this mainstream media reporting around food and climate that is biased, that is full of misinformation, that is lacking in context, that is too American, when really, let's be honest, 60% of the world lives in Asia and we only have 20% of the world's agricultural land and we have a water issue coming up.
Yeah.
So a lot of this future food fight and kind of challenge is going to happen here in Asia, where we're going to suffer from the effects of the climate crisis much more. So there you go. So everything's skewed. And so these media folks are not, it's not their fault. It's just that training isn't there. It's akin to how doctors are not trained in nutrition. It's the same, it's very similar. And so my new projects are around all of this. This is what I want to focus more of my time on, which is how do I give people toolkits and information and framing that helps them do their job better and tell this food and climate story more accurately, more fully, more creatively, more importantly, because there is no such thing as a future of humanity without abundant, safe, nutritious, ethically produced, sustainable food.
Yes, absolutely. Do you think that, I mean, I feel like if the food industry is not like the pharmaceutical industry or energy or transportation, you build a car and it's a car, whether you ship it to the US, to Europe or Asia, it's still the same car. But food is cultural. Every dish has their own habits and specific tastes. And although it's becoming a melting pot, Italian food is Italian food, but obviously a lot of people have burgers, but it's not part of their culture. Do you see that this is one of those issues that is making food regulatory processes and the overall food system, let's say, more challenged?
Absolutely. I literally say those exact same words to people all the time. I used to say that a lot more when the alternative protein industry first started forming, because again, I felt that there was a one mindset kind of dominant that was something that I, as the publisher and editor-in-chief of a media company based in Asia. And as someone that is half French and half Indian and grew up in Hong Kong, was not able to push forward in the same way because, you know, at Green Queen, we have mostly non-vegan readers.
Mm-hmm.
And so our job is to really make the discussion and the news and the solution journalism that we are doing inclusive and open and diverse. And so I think that what ended up happening is that it's become a bit of a one-trick branding or messaging post
mm-hmm.
that has made people feel that their food identity is under attack.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is productive.
Absolutely. I mean, you wrote about it. I wrote about it. You know, if you take the Italian situation now, right, we have, you know, a government that is extremely anti-progress in a way, to the extent that they banned ChatGPT. They're banning the use of international terms, which to me, it's a little weird. So, and obviously what's happening with the alternative protein space, which they see, which is a very small percentage, I would say, of people, they see this as an attack on farming, which to me, it should be an opportunity for farmers to diversify their production methods, because soon here, you won't be able to farm the way that people have farmed. You know, the climate, when we have temperatures like Dubai, it's not going to be very productive, right? So they have to diversify. And the fact that people are scared and fearful and nobody is saying the right things and educating people, it's, I think, one of the biggest challenges.
This is where it's gone wrong. How did we end up with this kind of sector that is actually built on really noble and really important and really necessary ideals,
mm-hmm.
you know, to create a more just food system that hurts animals less, that feeds people better, that is buttressing itself, bulwarking itself against a future where agriculture is going to be ravaged by the climate crisis. I mean, these are all really important things to solve for. And these are all really wonderful missions to have. But somehow we've ended up alienating farmers
yep.
and food people. It's not just the farmers. Chefs won't touch it.
Yeah.
Food people. People who like to cook. When you are, and that's been something that's always been such a really personal issue for me, because I'm a huge cook.
Yeah.
My mother has written a cookbook. My grandmother was known as being one of the best cooks, home cooks in Delhi, in India. You know, I come from food is love. Food is how you show love. I still do it. I was just complaining last night that it's so sad that we've become a world where if you do a birthday party for your kid and you make a homemade cake, people think that you're a kind of a loser that has no money.
Yeah.
That's what's happened in Hong Kong, because everybody's competing with the billionaires who hire these cake shops who make these ridiculous, like $500 to $1,000 cakes that nobody actually wants to eat because they don't taste good.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, my mother lovingly makes my son his birthday cake, and she makes it 100% vegan. And she makes these beautiful creations. You know, so far she's made a dinosaur, a lion, and now she made a fire truck. I'm talking like this takes her 2 days. These cakes are probably more in ingredient costs than the one from the bake shop. But somehow people see that as less than. We've ended up with a definition of wealth that doesn't include real food.
Yeah.
And so food, except if it's Michelin, but then you have, you know, the best restaurant in the world that says to you, actually, in order to operate at the level that billionaires want to eat at, we have to exploit people. So we've got to close down because, hey, this model doesn't work. And so you've got this sort of messed up view of food and value and kind of nourishment that is just heartbreaking, right?
Yep.
Because to me, spending 2 days making a cake at home for your grandson is the most beautiful, endearing symbol of love. But we're so messed up as a society that we don't understand that. We don't value that anymore, you know?
Yep.
I mean, of course, some people do, and we're going to keep doing it. But so many people don't value it because we've now tokenized food and commodified food. And it's not even about the food. It's about the Instagram photo.
Yeah.
And so we're messed up in how we deal with food. And food culture is undergoing huge amounts of changes. People are cooking less. As you get younger and younger, people cook less. But then you have this older generation of people who have done things differently and who feel completely, you know, left out, excluded, ignored, judged for wanting to continue their culinary traditions. And that's wrong.
Yeah.
It's wrong that we have pitted all this against each other.
Yeah.
The future should not be a vegan burger versus, you know, a lovingly made Italian ragu sauce. That's not the argument. That's not what we're saying. We're saying, hey, 2 billion people eat a McDonald's burger made from livestock beef agriculture that is responsible for 14 to 18% of greenhouse gas emissions. We cannot decarbonize without finding a solution for those 2 billion burgers.
Absolutely.
That's not the same thing as attacking the Italian ragu.
Yep. I believe in a diversified food system where we farm better regeneratively, like looking at soil health and nutrient density, where the food is actually food and not water, sugar, and flavor. And on the other side, you need alternative proteins because it's not just about yield, right? You have to feed. So everybody can have whatever they want, but it's just going to be better food. To me, instead of having crappy food, which is what we have.
Right, which nobody wants to talk to. So the regen people are pretending that we're living in a world where everybody's eating regen beef and kale salad.
Yep.
Farmed in their garden. That's just not true. Of course, not everybody sees the world the same way. And while I do believe that the vast majority of humanity would not want to endorse a world where animals are treated cruelly, I have spoken to many people that believe that if animal welfare is truly respected, they are not necessarily ethically opposed to eating meat. And that is, I'm not sure we get to a place where everybody agrees that ethically you shouldn't eat animals.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen. So, you know.
So what do we do, you know?
Well, that's why we need a diversified food system where people that would like to go vegetarian but like meat too much will be able to because of good alternatives like cultured products or fermented products. And vegetarians that really like meat but are not eating it for ethical reasons will be happy. And for those that don't want to go that way, they can have better farmed produce, which at the end of the day is going to be healthier. So whether grazed or lab grown, everyone has a solution. But to get there, we need real education.
Which I would argue we have been absolutely terrible at.
Yes.
And I have to say, I don't want to be the person that says I told you so, but I have been banging on about this for at least 3 years, telling investors, telling ecosystem leaders, telling trade association. I've been saying, guys, you're not getting the message through. I am all the time on panels talking to the public. You're not getting the right message through. And big meat and big dairy is coming in with their lobby dollars.
Yes.
And they are just, they're winning the argument because they have more money. And just sitting there and saying, no, but it's okay. Once we're cheap enough, And once we're, you know, accessible enough, the problem will solve itself. I'm not so sure. I don't think you can use the same argument for the EVs that you can for food because of all the things that you talked about, which is that food is identity, food is culture, food is family, food is tradition.
Yeah. Picking up on what you just said, take the government trying to ban alternative protein here in Italy. A study put 54% of the population was pro-cultured meat. And the reason why all of this started was because of a lobby, a farmers association that's so scared and spewing misinformation, scaring others. It's a bit like the 2016 elections, if you believe. This is the world we live in, super fragmented, where the truth just matters a lot less. But because they are very loud and ignorant about the possibilities, this is what's happening. And if we don't take Italy, we can look at inner city kids all over the world that have no clue where food comes from. So,
but we don't prioritize.
Yeah.
This goes back to the birthday cake discussion. We don't prioritize this. We only prioritize a Michelin experience or a convenient drone delivered experience.
To that segment of the population, but inner city.
Yes.
You know, education should start in kindergarten around food, in my opinion.
I agree. I hung out with some surgeons recently when I was in California. I stayed with a couple of surgeons and I was talking to some of them and they don't have any education on nutrition. None. That's it. Like, none. It's not even on their mind when they talk about their patients.
Yes. Well, nutrition is like a foreign subject unless you are a nutritionist, whether for humans, pets, or everything in between. While health and food are so vital and go hand in hand.
That's the transparency around nutrition and nutrition, the problem with it is that it's a politicized field that also has to do with, you know, national food security in different countries and food policy. And then you start getting into that.
Yeah. Speaking of policies, which to me are front and center, if you want anything to change, it has to come from regulatory and policies for each country. What do you think that should look like across the globe?
So that's a really good question. I mean, what do I wish it looked like today? If I were the queen of the world, then it would be, let's get transparent about emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's bring those down. Let's put in, like, literally, I think that we should have waste. You can call it, you can call it a tax or an incentive, depending on how you think it should best be framed. But I think that there should be greenhouse gas and waste and toxicity emission, I mean, incentives or taxes.
Yeah.
So I think that corporates should have to pay the consequences of having businesses that cause pollution, whether it's air pollution, soil pollution, health pollution, that cause health issues like serious toxicity. I think that there should be a price to pay for waste and management and end of life. And that really goes around my whole world in all my work around removing plastic and materials and packaging. And that's my third business, Just Source Green. I really believe in that. And then finally around food, you know, or around your business model in general, like, what is the full greenhouse gas emission cost of your business, scope 1, 2, and 3? And let it, you know, if you don't get within a certain agreed upon limit, then you're taxed or you have to pay for that. And I think that that's the only way that we can get to a point where there's true fundamental systems change. And I think what's interesting is that if you look at certain industries and certain examples, this is already beginning to happen. Because one area that I think is really interesting to look at in food is food service. So companies like Sodexo and Compass Group who serve corporate cafeterias, school, university cafeterias, public cafeterias, like for example, prisons or things like that.
Yes.
Right, like government cafeteria. They have been doing a lot more work around what is their scope 3 emissions, right?
Yeah.
And And there's a whole, like, we could have a whole argument and or a full discussion on scope 3 emissions. And the big problem with scope 3 emissions is most people don't know how to measure them, and there's not enough tools around it. There's not enough transparency, et cetera. But assuming that we provide incentives to better manage and measure scope 3 emission, there's a lot of kind of evidence to show that once companies are told that they have to reach certain targets, they change. And so what's happening is companies like Sodexo and Compass Group are actually altering the percentage of plant-based meat that they serve to third party in cafeterias because they need to lower their own footprint.
Yeah.
So I think that you do solve this with more transparency, better reporting, and then eventually policy to limit that. Because at the end of the day, why should the average citizen be forced to pay in the consequences for a business model that is causing, that is worsening climate change, causing pollution, causing waste that no one, that is unaccounted for, right?
Yes.
And I mean, then I think you should also add in things like biodiversity kind of incentives or taxes, right? So if we had all of these, I mean, we know the answers here.
Yeah.
You can choose whether you prefer the carrot or the stick approach, but we know the answers and we know what needs to be done, but the political will to do it is not there.
True.
I would have to say across the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Regardless of what people say or what you read, in reality, it isn't, because as we said before,
no.
Lobbies are too powerful to, you know, say if you do good, you'll get incentives. If you do bad, you get taxed. I'd see it like that, right?
100%.
Neocapitalism.
100%.
So how do we fast track innovation systemically? How do we start looking at things holistically without even that fighting within ourselves, you know, just because we have difference of opinion? How do we do that? How do we fast track it? How do we make people understand?
Well, I think it's really important to come at it with inclusivity and understanding and empathy. Unfortunately, politics, social media, algorithms, the mainstream media, clickbait, misinformation, fake news, all of these things are meant to divide us and to create this artificial world of us versus them for every conversation about every topic. And I think that we really have to fight that. We really have to fight that. We are not going to, you know, make anyone change their minds by attacking people.
Yeah.
So I think that's really, really important. I think that we need better resources and toolkits around messaging. I think that one thing that I'm really, really focused on and wanna work on is, how do we get better marketing, brands, communication, content, creativity, talent to join our cause? And I penned this post the other day. I was really surprised that it went quite viral on LinkedIn. And I was even more happy, first of all, at how international the response was. And I think that that really is so important to me, that everything I'm doing is speaking to the whole world, not just to the US or not just to Europe. And what I was really heartened by was how many messages I received from marketers and comms people and just experts in kind of getting messaging across, storytellers, you know, and saying to me, I really want to help. What can I do? And so I'm trying to figure out a way to get all this talent kind of in a room together, or in a virtual room, most likely, and to do a giant powwow to figure out how to better talk about this by people who've actually done the work. Because what's desperately missing from a lot of this solution investing and impact investing and alternative proteins and all the kind of verticals here and all the kind of groups that are working to solve what is such an important, once again, problem or set of problems, is what's missing is that basic kind of customer segmentation work,
mm-hmm,
of who are we talking to and are we using the right language and who are these people? Let's let's bring some empathy and understanding to the table. And let's find out what makes their heart beat faster. And let's talk to them on their terms. No one's doing that. Honestly, no one's doing that. The VCs aren't doing it. The ecosystem organizations are not doing it. The startups are not doing it. And everyone's got a reason. You know, VCs don't invest in education and startups don't have budget for marketing or branding. And the ecosystem organizations are busy with policy. But I got to tell you, I mean, it just shows once again to me something that is so evident in our society, which is that we come at everything with such a lack of empathy. It's a me world. It's an individualized based world. And we're not listening to people.
Yeah.
And what is the farmer revolt in Italy really about? We haven't listened to them. And they deserve to be listened to on some level.
Oh, absolutely.
Do I agree with their tactics? Do I agree? No, but I want to be in the table and listen to them and I want to hear what they have to say.
Yes. In fact, speaking with regenerative farmers a while back, and despite the fact that without any information, they were very much against alt protein, vertical farming, really the use of technologies and the opportunities. But once we explained such opportunities and really the purpose and the need for these types of technologies, that the fact that different climates and nations might need different things, they were actually inspired in understanding that everything had a place and a space. And when something doesn't work, there are other alternatives that one can try that can support that same livelihood that they are scared to lose. So we are all trying to do the same thing. We are all trying to create a more resilient food system. So I think that should be the conversation.
I feel very hopeful of younger generations because I see my daughter and my daughter's friends. They're so different than from people my age. Do you think that younger generations are the ones that will do everything that we talked about?
I agree, with one caveat. I think that younger generations seem to be trained to have a lot more respect for different opinions. They are much more naturally inclusive. They are much more worried about the planet and the fate of animals. They are more worried about supply chain workers than any of us. So there's a lot to be hopeful for on the collective front. So collectively, I think they're far and above where we are. My caveat to that is that I still think that because of social media, and because of the way our mainstream media system works, and because of the way algorithms prioritize polarization, they are still at risk of the us v them problematic. And that's not their fault. That's, we're all at that risk.
Yes, that is very unfortunate. It's in the past few years, the whole world is so polarized on every issue, everything.
Exactly.
And everybody for
families.
Yeah. Like with the with the Trump elections, I know families that stopped talking to each other.
So many, yeah.
Which to me is kind of crazy. So what kind of tips would you give to consumers to decarbonize their life?
I have really become someone who doesn't want to put the onus on a consumer because I think that really the onus is on governments and corporates. But I think that consumers can come at it from a world of better mental health through less consumption.
Mm-hmm.
I really do believe that we consume too much and it consumes us mentally. And so my number one tip as, you know, Green Queen on every panel I've ever been asked for the last 10 years is stop buying stuff. Like literally go 1 month where you buy nothing but food because you have to.
Yeah.
Nobody has come to me after doing that and not been happier and not been more thoughtful and not been more careful and not had a change happen inside of them.
Hmm. That's cool.
You've got to de-consumerize. You've got to stop just being a consumer of everything.
Yeah.
And my second one is to spend more time in nature and be awed by the majestic beauty that is the natural world. How can you not want to protect it? And then, of course, for food, I would say cook at home more. I'm sorry. It takes more time. That's a very unfair statement, though, for people who have a difficult socioeconomic situation. And so I will not put any stress on people who are struggling with, you know, two jobs and kids to raise and no time. I'm not here to judge anyone or to make people feel bad. I think that most moms want to give their kids the best food in the world. And if tonight that best food is nuggets, then God bless you. You're doing your best.
Yeah.
That's really got to not be some kind of elite judgment. But if you are someone who has means and has time and is lucky, then reacquaint yourself with the beauty and deliciousness that is, you know, food made at home with love.
Yeah. So my daughter, while I was speaking at a conference, I had her take a pasta class to make fresh ravioli and tortellini. And now she's doing a master's at LSE in the UK. She's teaching how to cook, make fresh pasta. I know she's making amazing desserts. She's on Eventbrite, and she really has a passion for cooking at home and wants to share that. To me, it's so cute.
When I was in college, I used to, this is going to date me, but more than a decade ago, I used to teach American girls how to make, I wasn't plant-based at the time, how to make roast chicken dinners.
Mm-hmm.
And I also used to teach people how to make Indian food. Nobody knew how to cook except me and in my group. And it's funny because most of the ladies were learning so that they could impress a date. That's why it was a roast chicken dinner. It was like the first like cooking date meal. So yeah, I hear you. I know what I get what she's doing, and she's probably going to be very, very successfully do more of it.
Yeah, she loves it. She's meeting people. She always loved to cook. We've always cooked. Every time she comes, make cakes and stuff. I'm a baker. I'm a crazy baker. So yeah, she loves to cook. So a couple more questions.
Tell me.
Yes. What are the new trends and buzzwords for 2023?
Okay, that's a great question. I would say new trend that I'm, okay, so first of all, everything regenerative seems to really be hitting a nerve in the same way that people are, you know, very kind of moving away from alternative protein, which I think is ridiculous because the thesis for the space has not changed, but I do get a lot more press releases around regenerative. I would say that what's definitely missing in that area is a set of definition and standards that can be applied across the board, because from what I can see in the press releases, people are self-defining,
yeah,
which I don't think is ever that great of an idea. Another big trend is you know, valorizing side streams, upcycling waste into products, you know, finding new ways to use existing agricultural kind of excess or byproducts.
Yeah.
That's really huge, whether it's in materials or in food. Or even in kind of other like building construction materials, et cetera. Those would be the two things I'm seeing more and more. And then a trend that I think is underrepresented and underdeveloped and underserved, but we just reported on it today, is food for women.
Mm.
Not moms, but women. I think femtech is having a moment. I think we're finally starting to fight the whole medical misogyny ordeal that you know, I've certainly experienced and lived through and been talking about for 10 years. There are a lot more kind of solutions and startups aimed at helping women and their health and wellness journey.
Mm-hmm.
But what's not been looked at enough is, you know, how the huge potential that it is to serve women, especially in their late 30s, 40s, 50s, like basically aging millennials, and to give them what they want from a food and health point of view.
Got it. All righty. Last question. What's next for you?
Honestly, I have my hands really full, but what's next for me is I'm working on what we talked about in the beginning, which is how do I help journalists and the media a better frame and better report on food and climate? And how do I do the same thing? How do I get this message that food is climate out to the masses? So there's a kind of a media angle, for other media, and then there is a marketing angle. So that's what I'm working on, other than my day jobs.
Sweet.
That I'm always kind of working on.
Like I said, a huge plate. Well, I wish you luck. And it was great to have you on Fintech Junkies today.
It's been a pleasure too. Thank you so much for taking the time and for featuring me. I love your newsletter, and I've listened to so many episodes of the podcast. So it's really going to be fun to be able to be on it myself. Thank you, Sharon. And thanks for also being such a voice of reason and kind of nuance in the space. We need more.
Thank you. Same to you. Have a great rest of the day.
Thanks, Sharon.
Bye.
Bye.
Want to dive deep into food innovation? Subscribe to the Food Tech Junkies series. Tune in and listen to the industry's champions whose mission is to reinvent our future by collaborating and disrupting the status quo as a way to rebalance our planet in our daily lives. For more great content, visit our website at www.edibleplanetventures.com and follow us on social media on the Edible Planet Ventures channels.